Okay, how's everybody doing? Seems like everybody's filtering in here. I can stop sharing the music. I'm feeling better about this online thing. I'm starting to like find my groove here, I think, somewhat. At least it's not optimal, but we're figuring it out. We're getting used to things, I hope. All right, screen sharing. I gotta bring in my iPad. Oh no, I'm in the meeting already with the iPad. All I got to do is share the screen. Just when I said I thought I was getting the hang of this. All right. We are up and running. How is everybody doing? Everybody's good? I hope. I trust. And let's see if I've got everything up where it's supposed to be. You guys should be able to see my screen now. And it is Wednesday, April 22nd. And we're doing SN2 reactions today, SN2 and SN1. So that's what the lecture for today is going to be on. And we had just started introducing the SN2. So I'm going to kind of backtrack a little bit and just put the few initial things in that I had in looking at SN2. So SN2, substitution nucleophilic first order. That's what we're doing. Substitution nucleophilic first order. And so that's second order. So that's where the S, the N, the 2 comes from. And the rate for these chemical reactions we had discussed briefly before is equal to a rate constant, K, times R leaving group. And that's the concentration of R leaving group times the concentration of the nucleophile. And what we've got is a chemical reaction that looks like R leaving group reacting with some nucleophile. Frequently these have negative charges, but not always, going to form the nucleophile attached to the R group. Plus we wind up getting the leaving group, which comes off frequently with a negative charge, but not always. And in terms of looking at an energy diagram, that if we throw an energy diagram in for this, that this is a bimolecular reaction that goes through a single transition state that is exothermic in nature. So we have R leaving group plus the nucleophile, the transition state for the chemical reaction, and then we get the nucleophile attached to the R group, plus we have the leaving group that comes off. And so these are exothermic reactions. Our activation energy, of course, is there, and bimolecular in nature. When we look at the reaction mechanism, the nucleophile is attacking from the backside of the substrate that has the leaving group on it. And there can be different substituents which are in this location. And the nucleophile must attack the backside, kicking out the leaving group. It goes through a transition state. So we'll draw the transition state that has the nucleophile attached to the carbon and to the leaving group, both at the same time. The carbon is pretty much trigonal planar in its orientation. And the nucleophile has a partial negative and the leaving group has a partial negative. So that's our transition state. And then it goes to the product, I still don't have much screen left. I was looking to see if I could get some more screen out of this because I wanted this to be linear. And so what we'll do is we'll just clean this up a little bit and just make it a little bit closer so that I can fit everything on here in the same spot.
Should the leading group be a partial positive?
No.
Or the
leaving group's partial negative.
I see. Sorry.
You got it?
Yeah.
Okay. Good question. The leaving group is partial negative because it's coming off with a negative charge. And so the negative charge is being translated from the nucleophile to the leaving group, such that the nucleophile is now attached to the carbon, and the carbon is inverted, 1, 2, and 3, and I have the leaving group that comes off with a negative charge. And so the negative charge is basically moving from the nucleophile to the leaving group. And in the transition state, the negative charge is spread between the nucleophile and the leaving group. If anything, if we wanted to say anything had a charge on it, we would say that the carbon sort of had a partial positive charge and that these both these leaving groups are the partial negatives. So that's where the partial positive is, which means that the transition state is fairly symmetrical in its nature. And we also had the rate by substrate, such that the substrate could be primary, which is going to be faster than secondary, which is going to be a whole lot faster than tertiary. And it's good to note that this rate is the reverse, absolute reverse, of the general substitution rate. For substitution reactions. Which is usually the rate for substitution follows the order that it is tertiary, which is much faster than secondary, which is a whole lot faster than primary. But that is something that we're going to talk about a little bit later. So we'll bring that back up. Katrina 3, number 2, methyl groups maintain their orientation throughout the reaction. They maintain their orientation throughout the reaction, Katrina, in that if I were to observe the location of 2 and 3, that 3 is forward. So here in the beginning, it's forward. In the intermediate, it's forward. And in the final product, it's forward. But what has happened is that the tetrahedral center of the carbon has been inverted. So the carbon has been inverted. And by saying that it's been inverted, we generally mean something along the lines of an umbrella, that if you have an umbrella that is sort of sitting down this way with the, that is such a small picture. Let's just do it down here. That the carbon, if we think about an umbrella that has sort of this look to it, and we push the umbrella to a flat orientation, and then we push the umbrella even further, such that now the umbrella spokes are pointed this direction, the umbrella has been inverted. But if we track any particular rung of the umbrella, that rung doesn't really change location in where it's attached or its forward or backward nature. It's just on the other side of the molecule. And that is what is taking place with this carbon, with the group here that's number 3 and the group that's number 2, that the group stays forward, but it has been inverted and pushed through to the other side. And we'll talk about what that looks like and what that means for the stereochemical nature of the molecule that is undergoing the SN2 reaction. So that's a component as well that we will address. Let's do some examples of SN2s. And and this is an iterative process so that I don't give all of the information away at the beginning. we keep diving a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper into each one of these components of the SN2 reaction. And then when we go to an SN1 reaction, then we compare and contrast and look at the different mechanisms and why they're doing what they're doing. Okay, so some examples. Let's take an iodide. So this is N-propyl iodide, and we'll treat it with sodium acetate and acetic acid. So I'm using some shorthands for the different things that I'm doing here. So let's make these shorthands not shorthand, but let's draw them out. So here is the sodium acetate and the sodium cation that is part of that, and acetic acid, which is the protonated form of that. And the reaction that we see that takes place is that we get replacement of the iodide, which comes off by the acetate group. So the group that is coming in, that is my nucleophile, is replacing my leaving group. So we can do the leaving group in green and coming off as the negative anion. Let's do another one. We can have a bromide attached to five-membered ring system, and sodium methyl sulfide. And here what we get is a new bond to the sulfur, and we'll explicitly draw out the CH3 group, plus we get the bromide leaving group. So again, here our nucleophile is the sulfur anion, and that's being attached exactly where the bromide was, and the bromide is my leaving group. And it should come off as an anion, so it was missing its negative charge. We can have these reactions take place with alcohols. So we can have N-propanol reacting with, in this case, HBr. And this one requires some heat. We get the bromide, plus we get water coming off. This one's a little bit harder to see. The leaving group is here, although this goes through a slightly different reaction mechanism that we'll talk about in a little bit. The incoming nucleophile is the bromide. And so we have the incoming nucleophile, and we have the loss of our leaving group, which is coming off as water in there. And interestingly, we can also have reactions that look this way, such that we can just heat this reaction up. And if we look at this reaction and think about 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, that I can have an intermolecular reaction kicking out the bromide, in which case I can make a five-membered ring system, and the byproduct that comes off is HBr. So the leaving group can be here, and my nucleophile, the oxygen, and I can have an intermolecular reaction as well. Adding heat. Let's see, Eric, is that a reversible reaction? Which one? Let me label them out, A, B, C, D. So A, B, C, D. Which one are we referring to as C? C can be reversible, yes. All of these reactions can be reversible to a degree. So that when we were talking about reversible and irreversible reactions before, I would consider that all of these are fairly reversible to a degree. Probably D being the least of the reversible, but that one too can be reversible. And then Francisco adding heat. Yeah, the symbol that we're using, the triangle, means heat. And so each one of these reactions is being heated in that regard, whereas the other ones are done at room temperature. So slight differences in the way that the chemical reactions are being done. Okay, a little bit about reaction theory. We've talked a little bit about reaction theory before as well. And so this is a little bit of review in that if I have my nucleophile, that the nucleophile has electrons that are in the occupied orbitals, and there are orbitals below and orbitals above this. We have what's called the barycenter, and these are the occupied orbitals that are down below, and specifically the highest occupied molecular orbital. So that's not new terminology that you've seen me use. We've talked about that before. And we can have the LUMO for the electrophile. So this one will be the electrophile. And the LUMO orbital of the electrophile. And what we are doing is we are taking electron density and dumping it into the LUMO. So we're going from the HOMO of the nucleophile and dumping electron density into the LUMO of the electrophile. And that's what's making this reaction, this chemical reaction, work. So if I shrink that down just so we can keep that on screen at the same time, basically what we're doing is that if we take and look at some oxygen that has a negative charge on it, we'll put some R group out here, and we say that this is my nucleophile. And I'm looking at some carbon, and my leaving group, let's say the bromide, and these are all hydrogens, then the electrons that are here are in the highest occupied molecular orbital. So those are the electrons that we are using that are doing the attacking to make the new chemical bond. But the question is, what does that LUMO look like? And what is the structure of the LUMO? And where is the LUMO? Because it's easier for us to see the lone pairs. We understand that lone pairs are the valence electrons, and that those are the electrons that are going to be making the bond. But the question is, where is that LUMO? And why do I need to dump electron density into that LUMO? And what is the structure there? What does that look like? So we need to go back to valence bonding theory. So two ways to look at the LUMO. We can do molecular orbital theory or valence bonding theory. And we've talked about both of these before. So two ways, and we'll look at both. Two ways to look at the LUMO. And for every molecule, the LUMO is going to look slightly different, but because these are SN2 reactions, the LUMO is going to be very similar. It won't be identical, but very similar in almost all of these types of reactions that we're looking at. So two ways to look at the LUMO. We can use valence bonding theory. The valence bonding theory is sort of a localized idea. So localized sigma bond with, that's supposed to be a sigma star, with sigma star, which is the antibonding. So here, what we see is that when we look at the two different orbitals, and this is now on the electrophile, the first one is the sigma bond, and the second one is the sigma star, the antibonding. And the bonding orbital. So you remember what a sigma orbital looks like. So if I take the carbon and I look at the carbon bromine bond, then the sigma bond for this had small orbital lobes on this side and on this side, and then had basically a what looked like a spherical sort of orbital. And we went red in color and blue in color in terms of what that orbital looked like. And most of the electron density was centered between the bond, between the nuclei, which makes the bond. When we go to the antibonding orbital, the antibonding orbital has the electron density thrown to the outside. So now what I get is mostly an orbital that essentially has electron density, actually it's an absence of electron density, but it is the two orbitals, and we use green and yellow for these because they're unoccupied. So we have the green orbital and we have the yellow orbital, and that's unoccupied. And in terms of the rest of what is going on with that molecule, we have the hydrogens here, which are the rest of the molecule. And so that orbital really extends right out the back of the carbon in between all of the hydrogens is where the sigma star, and that is our LUMO orbital and what the LUMO actually looks like. And the highest occupied molecular orbital is here, but we're really focusing on the LUMO. I just wanted to draw the HOMO because you were more familiar with that first, and then bring in the LUMO into it. So what we're saying here is that electrons from the nucleophile must be placed into the sigma star orbital in order to disrupt the sigma bond. So electrons from the nucleophile must be placed into the sigma star to disrupt the sigma bond and eject the bromine. That's what's really taking place here. And so the question is, well, why does putting electron density into a sigma star bond disrupt bonding? And we can go back to that concept that when we looked at helium and bringing two helium atoms together, so this is helium one and helium two, and each helium has two electrons, and we tried to make helium diatomic. Remember the question of, well, why doesn't helium become diatomic? The reason is that helium doesn't become diatomic is because there's no net energy gain, and that dumping electrons, so this is my sigma orbital, this is my sigma star orbital, and that dumping in electron density into a sigma star disrupts bonding. It counteracts the bonding orbital and causes the molecule to fragment or to break. It disrupts the sigma bond. And so anytime we dump electron density into an antibonding orbital, we always disrupt or break a sigma bond in the process of making some new bond. And so that's the theory there. And so this goes back to, why isn't helium diatomic? Excuse me, yeah, helium, like hydrogen, you know, because hydrogen is diatomic. So hydrogen's diatomic, but helium is not, and it goes back to electron density in the sigma bond. Okay, the other way that we could look at this is we could look at it in terms of molecular orbital theory. And molecular orbital theory gives us a slightly different picture, but represents the same thing. So in molecular orbital theory, now what we do is we take an overall view of the molecule. So this is not localized. This is a molecular orbital. And in this case, the molecular orbital looks quite different. And we could actually pull it up It's got three orbitals that are in it, four, excuse me. And those orbitals, the major orbital is centered in this region. There's an orbital that is smaller, a lobe that fits in this region, another lobe that fits kind of over the bromide, and then another smaller one that's out of side of the molecule over this direction. And they rotate. These are unoccupied. And they look kind of like this. And so this is the major lobe. Of the sigma star molecular orbital. What is really the LUMO orbital. And that is where the partial positive resides, is in the largest lobe of the antibonding orbital. So the largest lobe of the antibonding orbital is the unoccupied orbital, and the unoccupied orbitals all have partial positives in them. That is the largest lobe of the partial positive, and that is where our nucleophile needs to come in and attack, is in that lobe. So it's the large coefficient, it's the large target. Equals the partial positive equals the large target. And it's the same idea. It's that when electron density goes into that antibonding orbital, we disrupt the bonding orbital. So all the same concept that we're both there. And what both of these show, both models show the need for a backside attack. Of the nucleophile on the substrate. And so both models are showing the exact same thing, that the nucleophile must come in exactly opposite the leaving group in order to put its electrons into the antibonding orbital and to kick out the leaving group. That's the main thing that has to happen there. And so when we look at that transition state, the transition state for this reaction that we're following, if we have some alcohol coming in and attacking, trying to leave myself enough room to draw, attacking some carbon with a bromide on it, and our electrons are coming in the backside, pushing out the leaving group, then we wind up going through some transition state. That did not do what I expected it to do. There we go. Some transition state where the R group and the oxygen are locked in to a linear arrangement with the leaving group, in this case, the bromide, where I'm getting partial minuses and partial minus here. And eventually going forward to becoming the products, in this case, an ether and the bromide minus. So that means that when we look at this in an energy diagram sense, that what I'm seeing is I'm going to put this up higher. That I have my alcohol attacking my substrate. I've got to kind of fit them in here, draw them a little bit smaller. And I'm going up to my transition state, which is up above, and my product. And it's the energy of the overall system not just the substrate itself and the transition state. And what we want to ask is, I know that we've drawn this transition state, we drew it up above, but what does Hammond tell us about this transition state? That if we're looking at the transition state itself, we've drawn this transition state as symmetrical, but is it truly symmetrical? Or does Hammond tell us something else? Is this an early or a late transition state? And this is where the power of Hammond starts coming in. So when we look at the Hammond postulate says the transition state will resemble the side with which it is closest in energy to. So the closest in energy is the starting material. So the transition state is closest in energy over here, which means that transition state is going to be starting material-like. It's going to look like the starting material in most regards. And so when we draw that transition state, it's not symmetrical. It is that we have the oxygen a lot farther away from the carbon than the bromide is. And that in terms of partial charges, my oxygen is going to have a large partial minus and my bromide a small partial minus. And that this is an early reactant-like transition state. So we've got an early reactant-like transition state. And this implies that the structure of the reactant will most influence the activation energy. So that's worth repeating. The structure of the reactant will most influence the activation energy of the reaction. Why is that true? That's true because if the material is reactant-like, any small changes in the nature of the reactant itself are going to have large effects within the transition state energy, which are then going to change the activation energy, the E sub A. So what we can say is that what's going on in this molecule is the sterics that happen with the nucleophile trying to approach the substrate. That the more sterics there are around the carbon, the harder it is for the nucleophile to be able to get in there. And by harder, we mean higher in energy. So if we put this sort of into perspective, if we have a nucleophile attacking the methyl, so we can do a couple of sketches here. If we have the nucleophile, and it doesn't matter which nucleophile it is, attacking a methyl group, with some leaving group, let's keep it the bromide. Then, and this is a methyl substrate, then our transition state or our reaction energy diagram is going to look like this, where my activation energy is that little tiny energy that's there. If I change this and make it a primary carbon, So now what I'll do is I'll put a CH3 group up here. And we'll have hydrogens down on the bottom. So this is now primary. What primary does is it increases the amount of sterics. I'm going to zoom in because it's so much easier for me to draw when I'm zoomed in. This increases the amount of sterics that are being felt by the molecule as the nucleophile is trying to approach and come in. And what that does is that increases the activation energy for the chemical reaction. And so here we get a taller activation energy for the methyl. Because essentially what we're doing is affecting the stability of the transition state by increasing sterics. Each time we increase sterics, we make the transition state just a little bit less stable, which increases its energy and raises the activation energy accordingly. If we go to now a secondary carbon, let's put the CH3 group in back. We'll keep this one a hydrogen in front. Now I've got even more sterics. And this one now being secondary increases my activation energy even more. And so what we're seeing is that we've got methyl, we've got primary, we've got secondary, and then we can fit tertiary in here in the bottom before this page ends out. And each time we're increasing activation energy as we increase sterics. So now we're tertiary. And the sterics increases so dramatically in the tertiary that the reaction becomes really unfavorable. And so what we're saying here is that when we're looking at these different rates, that the substrate effect on the rate is such that the E sub A for a tertiary is much greater than the E sub A for a secondary, which is greater than the E sub A for a primary. Ah, what is wrong with my hand all of a sudden? Okay, there we go, E sub A primary, which is also greater than the E sub A for a methyl. And that's why when we see that, that means that the rate of the reaction is such that primary is faster than secondary, is a whole lot faster than tertiary. That's where that rate is coming from in terms of substrate. And in fact, tertiaries don't undergo SN2. That a tertiary substrate is just so high in energy that the SN2 reaction becomes unviable. Eric, so for this reaction, that means that you need a higher temperature for the reaction. Yeah, in essence, what we do is that the higher the degree of substitution on the substrate, the higher temperature we need in order to push that reaction to go, because the activation energy is increasing. So yes, it requires more energy for each one of the reactions, which literally means requiring higher heat. So good observation, Eric. Absolutely, that is true. Okay. However, something interesting happens with alcohols. So let's talk about SN2 reactions with alcohols. as leaving groups. We mentioned what a good leaving group was. So the other day we talked about and we defined what a good leaving group is. And we said that a good leaving group equals a weak base. We didn't really define what a weak base was, but we know that we know a weak base when we see it from a strong base. So in other words, if I look at hydroxide, hydroxide is a strong base. Anything other than hydroxide tends to be a weak base. We know that hydroxides, in terms of our strong acids, we talked about strong acids the other day. We had nitric acid, sulfuric acid. We had HBr, HI, HCl. All of those were strong acids. Everything else is considered a weak acid. Well, in terms of bases, hydroxide are considered our strong base, and everything else is considered to be a weak base after hydroxide in terms of our just our aqueous acids and bases. However, so most of our leaving groups, something like Br minus, is a weak base. And so we have a good leaving group in a bromide, and we have a poor leaving group in a hydroxide. Which means that when we look at an alcohol, that this thing is a poor leaving group. And one of the things that an SN2 reaction requires is an SN2 reaction requires a good leaving group. So when we did the reaction before, where we took hydroxide here and reacted it with HBr, and we added some heat into this, and we got the SN2 reaction to go, and we made water, the question is, how is this SN2? Because of the poor leaving group, because this guy is just not coming off as a poor leaving group, it begs the question then, how do we get that SN2 reaction if that thing's a poor leaving group? And the reaction is stepwise. So the answer is that the reaction is stepwise. So we need to look at the stepwise nature of this reaction. So what happens is the first step in this reaction is not the SN2 step, but a protonation step, where the strong acid reacts to protonate the alcohol. Once we protonate the alcohol, now what we've got is a protonated hydronium, essentially. And the bromide then can act as the nucleophile, kicking out the hydronium ion, and we get the SN2 reaction. So this is the SN2 step. This step was protonation. And then the bromide is there and the water is kicked out. And we end up with a neutral leaving group, which is why the protonated hydroxyl is a good leaving group at that point. So what we did is we went from something that was a poor leaving group to something that all of a sudden became a good leaving group. And it really becomes a good leaving group in a large part because of that positive charge. Because once it comes off, it can be neutral at that point. And so we get a stepwise chemical reaction here. And if we take and draw the energy diagram for that, we start off at a fairly high activation energy of HBr and the alcohol. And we go through a small activation energy barrier, which takes us down to a lower energy state where we now have the protonated hydroxyl group and the bromide ion. And so there's a small activation energy there for the protonation step. And then what we have is we have the SN2 step, and the SN2 step is going to have a higher activation energy than the protonation step and come down even into lower energy, adding in the bromide and having the leaving group leave. And so this is our energy of activation for the SN2 step and is our rate determining step for the chemical reaction. So this step is fast. This step is our slow step and is our rate determining step. That is not a good line. I'll try that one more time. Okay, that's not so bad. So there's our energy diagram for this. And the hydroxyl must be protonated in order to make it into a good leaving group. So everybody understand that energy diagram and where I'm going and why this one is neutral. And here we have charges, but the charges are actually lower in energy because HBr is a strong acid. And because HBr is a strong acid, HBr has a higher pKa, lower pKa than does the protonated alcohol. So HBr, the pKa is somewhere like, -3, whereas hydronium, which is much like our protonated alcohol, has a pKa of -1. And so it's lower in energy to have the oxygen protonated than it is to have the bromide protonated, which is why it comes down in energy for that first step, and then down in energy even further once we go to the neutral molecule again. So that's an important part to mention. Let me stop there real quick and just say, how are we doing SN2-wise? Is everybody tracking the discussion here and how this is different for alcohols than it is for other types of leaving groups that do not need to be protonated? So I just want to check in and make sure that we're seeing that these reactions over here where I had a neutral leaving group, the bromide, just a single step reaction in which these are SN2s where the nucleophile hits the substrate, knocks out the leaving group. Whereas with alcohols, I need to have a two-step process, but inherently, the step that we're focusing on is this step here, that this step is the SN2 step. So everybody's catching that part, and that the protonation is really outside of the SN2 step.
Hey, Jason, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in the energy diagram, it shows the protonated alcohols being lower in energy than the unprotonated alcohol, but shouldn't it be higher in energy?
It's not. See, that's the part that I wanted to make sure that we're understanding, is that when we look at the energy, it is not the protonated alcohol versus the unprotonated alcohol. So it is not the energy of this versus this. It is the energy of the HBr and the alcohol, which, and the comparison of the bromide and the protonated alcohol, that this whole side is lower in energy. And that is due to the pKa of HBr, in that the pKa of the HBr is so much lower than the pKa of the protonated alcohol. So it's the entire reactants which are lower in energy, not just the alcohol versus the protonated alcohol on its own. That's an important concept, and thank you for asking that, Eric. Anybody else have any questions? And I think that's why I keep taking the time to draw all the reactants out in the energy diagram, that it's not just the substrate which is undergoing the chemical reaction, it's everything combined that is undergoing the chemical reaction. So we're looking at the energy changes of the overall system, not the energy changes of the substrate. It's a really important concept. That was great to hit that home. All right, everybody else doing okay then? Because we're going to move topics a little bit. We're going to focus on the stereochemistry. So we're going to take a look at the stereochemistry in a little more detail here. Okay, so inversion of configuration. In inversion of configuration, The configuration of the substrate gets inverted within the SN2 reaction, such that if I look at a substrate that has a stereocenter, so here what we have, I've put this on the back side. Maybe I shouldn't have, but that's the way I want to do the reaction. And let's just get 1, 2, 3, 4. And that means that I'm sweeping around clockwise, but the hydrogen's forward, so I have to reverse everything. So this is actually an S. So forward, which means reverse, whatever configuration we find out. So I know that I've swept this around in an R, but that really means that this is an S after correcting for sweeping around in the clockwise orientation. I hope I made that clear for everybody. So this is an S stereoisomer. And so I'm just going to redraw it here so that I can do my chemical reaction, which is I want to bring in a nucleophile, which is a sulfide. And we go through and we do the SN2 reaction where the sulfur comes in and kicks out the leaving group. We go through a transition state where both the sulfur and the bromide are connected at the same time. So without tearing up my geometry here, I'm going to turn the molecule and orient the molecule in a slightly different orientation where the hydrogen is now straight and the bromide is being kicked out and the sulfur with the hydrogen partially negatively charged for the bromide. That's my transition state. And these groups are in the process of each pushing this direction. So they're pushing through and inverting. And the product is going to come out of this. And the product that we get is with the hydrogen looking like this, the S and the H, the Br has been kicked out as a minus, and this literally is where the sulfur is forward and the hydrogen is back. So we had the hydrogen forward to begin with, and we went from an S stereocenter to now, if we reconfigure what this stereocenter is, sulfur gets number 1, 2, and 3. This stereocenter is now an R stereocenter. So we went from an S to an R. That is our inversion of configuration. However, I would say that the stereocenter, while always inverting, does not always change configurations. That's a hard thing to grasp. You can imagine that I could have an incoming nucleophile that the prioritizations would change. And so while the stereocenter will always invert, the renumbering of the prioritizations by bringing in a new nucleophile can reverse the configuration assignment. And so you may have an S substrate and get an S product, but it still went through inversion of configuration. And the stereocenter still did invert. So the inversion has to do with this idea or concept that each one of these groups is moving from the front of the molecule to the back of the molecule. And that is the inversion of configuration. So we've looked at the inversion of configuration. So the stereocenter has been inverted. Okay, so to summarize what we've got here is that in an SN2 reaction is a reaction where the nucleophile does a backside attack. Oh, first off, let's say this. It is a concerted mechanism. meaning single step in the transition state. It is that the nucleophile must attack the backside of the substrate in the sigma star orbital. Reaction proceeds via a symmetrical transition state and that symmetrical transition state is nonpolar. We didn't really mention that. That comes back around a little bit later. But to look at the polarity of the transition state, if I have a nucleophile that is coming in and attacking a carbon, which is symmetrical in nature, and the leaving group is being kicked out, and I have partial minus and partial minus, and partial positive at the carbon, given the geometry of the bond angle that is 180 degrees in the way that the nucleophile and the leaving group are there, this is very much like carbon dioxide, in that carbon dioxide is a nonpolar molecule because the dipoles counteract each other, because the dipoles are 180 degrees. And so the transition state of an SN2 is nonpolar in the same way that a carbon dioxide molecule is nonpolar. Even though I have partial negative charges, they are equal and opposite, and they counteract each other. And so we would say that the reaction proceeds via a symmetrical, mostly nonpolar transition state. Sterics increase the activation energy. So sterics of the substrate increase the activation energy of the reaction. And we're getting that from Hammond postulate. And that our rate is equal to K, R leaving group, the concentration of the R leaving group times the concentration of the nucleophile. And that increases in either concentration will increase the chemical rate because it's bimolecular and takes a collision. So the more molecules we have of either one of those, the more collisions we have, the more increased rate of chemical reaction we have. And that the rate based on the substrate is that primaries are faster than, much faster than secondaries, which are much faster than tertiaries. And so by substrate, we have that rate. And the K value that goes in front of this is telling us about the activation energy is sort of baked into that K value. So it's proportional to the activation energy, which is telling us about the sterics in the chemical reaction. Okay, so that's sort of our summing up of everything that we hit within the SN2 reactions. The only last thing that I would put in there is that alcohols as leaving groups need to be protonated. Or no chemical reaction. So an example of that is that if I take an alcohol and I try to do an SN2 reaction by reacting this with a nucleophile that happens to be a strong base. So I pick a strong base nucleophile, I'm trying to think of a good one that I want. Usually these are carbon nucleophiles. So let's pick a carbon nucleophile. Then what winds up happening is instead of the SN2 reaction, what I get is I get the acid-base reaction and I get no SN2. So this guy basically takes the proton, giving the electrons back to the oxygen, and there's no SN2. Then in order to do the SN2 reaction, what I need to do is I need to do the SN2 reaction with a strong acid. So I need to have HBr or something like that, where I first protonate the alcohol and it goes stepwise. Once it's protonated, then this group can come in and do the SN2 step, kicking out the water molecule. So the leaving group must be protonated if it is an alcohol as a hydroxyl group in order to be kicked out. All right.
I have a quick question.
Go for it.
Does leaving group, does backside always refer to the part that isn't the leading group?
Like, backside means always opposite the leaving group. So what we mean 180 degrees to the leaving group. So backside, when we say a backside attack, which is the way that it's always phrased, that means 180 degrees to the leaving group. So if I have the carbon and that's my leaving group, that whatever else is going on over here, that 180 degrees is my nucleophile coming in and attacking in 180 degree angle to the leaving group, because that's the location of the sigma star, is 180 degrees to the leaving group.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Because I'm about to jump into SN1 and start comparing SN1. So if there's anything on SN2 that you want to ask about, now's a good time to sort of hit the SN2 questions before we jump in. And here's the other thing too. We're going to spend, while you're thinking about your questions, we're going to spend a long time on these reactions, both SN1, SN2, and E1 and E2. And we go through the SN1, we go through the SN2, we go through the E1, the E2, and then we come back and we put them all together. And I bring a lot of data. So I'm only giving you part of the story right now. And what we're going to do is to not overwhelm you. I don't want to give you everything right now. We sort of present these with the critical information for each reaction. And then in subsequent chapters, we bring in, or I bring in, a lot of data that gives you data on the chemical rates and data on solvent and how solvent affects things and how much does this rate really change from going from primary to secondary to tertiary. And so later on, we give all that data, and that's really critical data to then make assessments as to which reaction is going to go faster, an SN1 or an SN2, an E1 or an E2, and how to make all those judgment calls. So there's going to be a lot more data that's coming your way, and data-based arguments rather than just structurally based arguments that we're going to present. So there's a method to the madness is what I'm trying to say. And it may seem overwhelming right now, but it'll get better as we go on and we present it multiple times and you get multiple exposures to the material. So I know that it can be overwhelming all at once. Okay, while I was speaking, did anybody come up with any other questions, or should we jump forward to SN1 now?
I had a question. So you mentioned it, but could you remind me what SN and E stand for? And the superscripts?
Yeah. So when we're looking at SN1, SN2, E1, E2, these are substitution. So the SN and the 1 is substitution, nucleophilic. And this is first order. And then SN2 is the same thing, but it's second order. It has to do with the rate law. E1 and E2 are elimination reactions. So it's an elimination first order and elimination second order. And by order, the order is the rate. So when we look at an SN1 reaction, the rate of the reaction is K times our leaving group. no nucleophile involved. It's just first order. The rate on a second order is equal to K times our leaving group times the nucleophile, running out of space. On the first order, the rate on a first order elimination is K times our leaving group, whereas the rate on the second order is K times our leaving group times the concentration of whatever base it is that you're using. So the first and second order are talking about the rate order, the rate law of the chemical reaction, and whether that rate law is a first order rate law or a second order rate law. First order meaning dependent only upon the concentration of one species. Second order rate law, dependent upon the concentration of two different species multiplied together. So those are, that's just a quick overview of what the names mean.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Anything else?
Is there a third order substitution nucleophilic?
There is not a third order substitution nucleophilic that I know of. Very few chemical reactions that we'll look at, none actually that we'll look at, are third order. So a third order chemical reaction would depend on three different molecules, which would depend upon a trinary collision, three molecules coming together at the same time, colliding at the same time. That's actually a fairly rare event within chemistry. In order to have two things collide, that happens all the time, but to have three things, a triple collision, is not very common within organic chemistry. It's just probability-wise, it's a rare probability to have three items come in and collide at the same time. Not to say that it doesn't happen. It's not to say that there aren't chemical reactions that are third order in their reaction rates, but none that we really study.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Could you real quick go, it's at like the very beginning of your lecture, but you did like an overview of the mechanism of an SN2. Could you just explain the inversion of configuration with that basic model? I don't know if you, I know you mentioned something, but I think I might've like numbered it wrong. So it's not making sense to me.
I think.
Like right under the very, should be above that.
That is the umbrella thing that I was trying to do.
Yeah, so, right below that, yeah.
The inversion of configuration, well, we can do both of these. So there was a place where I dealt with that specifically, but numbering in this regard is, I'm trying to think how I want to represent this. If I take and put the leaving group back, and I think about this as a Newman with the leaving group back, it is 1, 2, and 3. And so in terms of, this is a counterclockwise and an S for the starting material. If I do a Newman and put the nucleophile back on the other side, then what I get in the system is I get 1, 3, and 2 with the nucleophile back. And so this is now going around clockwise and is an R. Does that help, Linnea?
Yeah, perfect, thank you.
Okay. That's similar to what I was trying to do down here where I talked about inversion of configuration. Although I didn't draw the Newmans in this one and I didn't have the numbers on this one. This was more an actual example at looking at how it inverts and doing R and S with it. But I think that helped a lot actually when in terms of going back and adding those Newmans to the first page there. So that's good. Okay. Let's, you know what? If I start SN1 now, I've got like 5 minutes in this example. And if I start SN1 now, let's just do a little bit. I can't let go. I was gonna say, is there any reason to do it right now? But substitution, let's just look at the rate. Substitution, nucleophilic, first order. And what's happening in this one is the leaving group is coming off and giving me a substrate with a carbocation. And whatever nucleophile is coming in is then coming in and attacking that carbocation in a second step. And so what's also here is I should really include the fact that the leaving group has popped off. And then what I get is my nucleophile bound to my R group, plus I get the leaving group coming off. And it looks on its surface, if I just look at the overall chemical reaction, it's a substitution reaction. It doesn't look any different than the starting material looked for the SN2 reaction. So the overall SN2 and the overall SN1 give you the same product, but they approach that product by a very different mechanism. And so the mechanism that is happening here is one in which if we take and look at the reaction, we've got our leaving group and we have the nucleophile floating around at the same time. The leaving group spontaneously leaves of its own accord, taking us to a high energy intermediate. Such that we have a very high activation energy. And this is our rate determining step. Up here, what we have is we have an intermediate, which is a carbocation. We have the nucleophile, which is negatively charged. And we have the leaving group, which is negatively charged. They're all sitting around up here at the same time. The nucleophile comes in and attacks the R group. And the entire thing then comes down to a lower energy state, still exothermic in nature, where I get the nucleophile now bound to the R group, plus I get the leaving group, which is hanging out. And there are two different transition states and two different activation energies. But I have one rate determining step. And so it is that one rate determining step that I'm really interested in. And the question, I guess really, is why does this leaving group just pop off in this way? And that's what we really need to explore. But the rate of the chemical reaction is equal to K times just the concentration of our leaving group. And that's all the rate depends on. Is the structure of the substrate and how good the leaving group is, and in some instances, how stable the carbocation is. So examples of these types of reactions, if we just look at a couple of examples, what we'll see is that these, in terms of what they look like, they look very similar to what we did before. They can be linear, such as this case, or they can be cyclic. And I'm using a couple of different, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I know that we don't know the structure of all of these things, but the reactions don't look all that different from what we did before. But the mechanism is very different. So there's just a couple of examples. And one of the things that you'll note is that when we look at the center that is undergoing the chemical reaction, these centers are typically tertiary. So these are the centers that are undergoing the substitution. The substitution is occurring at a tertiary center. And that's because when we look at the rate of an SN1 reaction is that tertiaries are faster than secondaries, are a whole lot faster than primaries. this has the reverse reaction rate of the SN2. And so what we're going to need to do is we're going to need to sort of break down these reaction mechanisms. We will go back and we will use Hammond postulate. And we will talk about Hammond postulate and what that transition state of that rate determining step looks like, and develop ideas and concepts that are governing this SN1 that are different than are governing the SN2, and why the reaction rate is actually the reverse. And how do we recognize it? How do we understand it? And how do we know whether a reaction is going SN1 or SN2? So that's where we're going. That's where we'll pick it up in the next lecture. And let's open it up for a few minutes of questions. We'll get a couple of questions in. Anybody who wants to tune out can tune out at this point. I'll pick you guys up in the afternoon lab, and I'll hang out and answer any sort of after class questions that you may have. So go ahead and fire away.
What does OTS stand for?
Oh, OTS is a type of leaving group. It's a tosylate leaving group. So OTS is, and like I said, I was going to go through some of these a little bit later, but OTS as a leaving group is equal to an oxygen connected to a sulfur that has a six-membered ring system connected to it and a methyl group on the end. And that was the point of connection, such that this oxygen that is here, the oxygen is that piece, and the overall thing is called a tosylate. And so the tosylate is abbreviated as TS. That's the functional group that we use there. They're very good leaving groups. And so they're a good leaving group because when they come off as a good leaving group, it comes off as the anion, and the anion has plenty of resonance to each of the oxygens and electron withdrawing nature from the sulfur, which makes it a very stable anion and a very, very weak base, and therefore a very good leaving group. Yep, hence the TOS. Okay, Eric, well then, how would a tosylate be attached to the molecule? Oh, that's in how we make it. That's what we gotta talk about, how we actually make it, Eric. So that's a whole different topic of how do we make tosylates. And that is a topic that we're going to teach you how to make tosylates and all the molecules that are related to tosylates. There are mesylates, there are tosylates, there are triflates. There's all sorts of different really good leaving groups, and how we make them is in a different way. And we're very careful about temperature, because if you increase the temperature too much on a tosylate, you can fragment the tosylate. The tosylate can leave, leaving behind the carbocation, and your molecules can break down. So we always sort of protect those from heat. But that's a great question, Eric, and I'll address it later. I'm not going to teach you how to make a tosylate right now, but we'll get there.
Is a tosylate a third order rate?
No, tosylate is still, in this case, a primary, first order rate. So no third orders yet. In fact, for the entire year, I'm not gonna present a third order reaction rate because we just don't have any. There's none that we cover within the organic chemistry that I can think of.
Oh, sorry, I'm at third degree.
It's a third degree leaving. It's still on a tertiary carbon. So the carbon, remember, the carbon is defined by how many other carbons it's attached to. So there are three other carbons that the red carbon is attached to, which means that the tosylate is a tertiary tosylate, much in the same way that we would have a tertiary chloride or a tertiary alcohol. They're categorized in the same way. Yes, that is correct. Anything else? Everybody, we got all these hangers on waiting to see what other questions are going to come out. Sort of like the end of class where everybody like sticks around at the end of class waiting to see what questions are going to be asked, just to make sure you don't miss anything. Catch all that wisdom. Anybody else? All right, I'm going to remind you guys that I'm going to be available for office hours at 1:30. So feel free to jump in at 1:30. And if you have any other questions or any things that you want to catch in that sort of format where there's less people sticking around, absolutely come and jump in at office hours at 1:30, and I'm happy to address more things. Or if you want to talk about lab or any of the other stuff that we've done, I'm happy to address those things in office hours too. So feel free to jump back in at 1:30, and I'll be here hanging out have some more music on, and we'll do it that way. All right. Thank you, guys. I'm going to take a break. I'm going to go get lunch. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. It's a beautiful day out there, and I'll talk to you later.